This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Falling off the cliff. That's how families often describe it when their kids with developmental disabilities turn 21 and can no longer receive the services they got as children from the school system. And so parents apply for help from the state, which by law it's supposed to provide. But some years, money's tight, creating a waiting list for services. And a bill heard today in the legislature seeks to increase funding. But while money has been part of the problem, it's not the only problem. Management has also been an issue. Instances where the funds are there but are not being properly dispersed. Today in The Exchange, why the waiting list? Let's hear from you. The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have three guests. With me in studio is Christine Santanello. She's director of the Bureau of Developmental Services for the Department of Health and Human Services. Christine formerly led Lakes Region Community Services. And Chris, it's nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for having me, Laura.
Also with us, Jennifer Bertrand. She's co-chair of the Policy Committee for the New Hampshire Council on Developmental Disabilities. She has a daughter with developmental disabilities. And Jennifer, thank you for making the trip. I really appreciate it. It's messy out there.
Aw, thank you for having me, Laura.
Joining us by phone, Sandy Pelletier, President and CEO of Gateways Community Services, an agency in Nashua. And Sandy, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's just start with the basics. And I think I'll turn to you first, Sandy, actually. What is a developmental disability for someone who has no idea what that really means?
It's an individual who has, in some cases, mental retardation, maybe cerebral palsy, autism, and that they have lifelong needs. Their abilities may they may have challenges in school, but they basically need supports to live a meaningful life.
Lifelong needs. So this is not something that's going to be cured or go away.
No, it's in many cases is diagnosed at a very young age, these youngsters come into our system and our early intervention program for birth to three. There are about 300. We serve about 300 infants and statewide. Chris Santanello, probably about 1,000 children a year get supported with early intervention. So to many of us, we meet some of these families very early on.
The Federal Centers for Disease Control describes developmental disabilities as a, quote, diverse group of severe chronic conditions that are due to mental and or physical impairments. So I'd love to hear from you, too, Chris. You know, in layperson's term, what does that mean?
It means someone that has an intellectual disability. And like Sandy said, it's lifelong. And so many times the area agencies will start with a family at birth. And in order to qualify for services, the person has to exhibit lifelong support needs. So that could be related to some learning difficulties, autism, cerebral palsy. There has to be a connection with intellectual functioning. But at the same time, we look at someone's ability to how supports will help somebody to maintain a meaningful life.
So it's a big range, Chris, right?
It's a
I mean,
huge
from
range.
Autism, where, you know, some people with autism can function pretty well, all the way up to not being able to move or speak. It's a big range of people.
It's a very wide range of people, absolutely.
Jen, tell us about your experience with this issue.
Well, you know, I have a 17-year-old daughter who has a lot of challenges. But with the right supports and services, she has achieved some monumental things, you know, and that means as a parent, you work with your local school system to advocate for your child for a free and appropriate public education. As a family, we support, you know, an inclusive educational approach. We want Chloe to have the same opportunities and be exposed to high academic standards, just like her sister and her brothers. And we want her to have opportunities to to engage in community recreational activities, to volunteer, to, as she gets older, she's already started. We were working with the school, and she's doing some internships at a local store in Amherst. She had done one with Maverick's Bike Shop. She worked in, like, their shipping and receiving, and she's also going to be working with Marshalls. We're really thinking about, now that she's 17, in this transitional age, we're thinking about what's to come in adulthood and how can we make her job and career ready? What skills and interests does she have? How can we help to support that so that she can, live up to her potential and live a full and meaningful life?
So we're going to hear those words a lot this hour, Jen, supports and services. So it sounds like Chloe is able to do a fair bit. And by the way, what 17-year-old girl wouldn't want to work at Marshall's with all those clothes? But what do you mean by supports and services? Just what does that mean?
So Chloe does have some profound challenges. She doesn't use verbal speech to communicate, but she makes vocalizations that indicate if she's happy or not so happy about something. She uses some sign approximations. She also uses a touchscreen speaking device, so she has her own voice. And she's really good at, let's say, requesting certain things that she likes, but it's hard for her to be conversational. And she does, because of the profound nature and severity of the disability that she has, she does require support with all of her activities of daily living. You know, she has certain levels of independence, and we're always working on helping her to become more and more independent. Our direct support professionals are really working hard to put themselves out of a job. The reality is, you know, she does have a profound developmental disability. She is diagnosed with autism. She needs one-on-one assistance to make sure she's safe and to be able to engage in all the things that we do on a day-to-day basis, you know, making something to eat, getting dressed, and taking a shower, and, you know, those all those activities that we do. And she'll probably need that support as she goes on through the rest of her life. So we worry a lot. What's going to happen when she turns 21? Will the legislature adequately fund developmental services? Because if they don't, that could mean some harsh realities for our family in terms of, you know, do I have to quit my job? Can I continue to work to support my other children through college? Can I continue to save for the things that she's going to need when I'm not here?
Well, and let's lay that out for people, how it works. So up until 21, I'm sure it's not perfect, but, you know, the services are there, the system is there. And then after 21, falling off the cliff, Chris, that's what people call it. What is that?
Well, excuse me, up until the age of 21, birth to age 3, the area agencies provide supports to children who have early intervention. From about 3 until 21, the school district provides the majority and all of the services for children, young adults who have developmental disabilities. The area agencies provide a lot of family support to families at that time, which is really an important component of
our
system.
At that transition time, you mean?
From birth up and through 21.
Okay.
So Sandy, I'm sure, can talk about it, as well as Jen and my experience working at an area agency. You know the families from early intervention up on through the lifespan. So it's an amazing opportunity. It's wonderful to develop those relationships. And really what the area agencies, as well as the Bureau, likes the area agencies to do is to really try to understand and articulate what families like Jen's and other families are going to need when their son or daughter turns 21. Because we need to start planning budgetarily, and then at the agency level, they need to start preparing programmatically. So when someone turns 21, A, we have the funds adequately allocated to them, and the agency knows exactly how to support the family.
So, Sandy, again, you've worked with a family, let's say, and all of a sudden the child is, you know, 18, 19, 20, and those school-based services are going to go away. They're supposed to be provided by the state from there on out, but there's this developmental disabilities waiting list that we always hear about. Why is there a waiting list?
Mentioned earlier, there's always more need than there are availability of resources. I think the legislature really has made a lot of effort. This has been a bipartisan effort by New Hampshire legislature for a number of years in the governor's office. In 2007, there was a really concerted effort to fully fund the waiting list as best as the New Hampshire could do. What happens is we all plan, all of the 10 area agencies work really hard to start planning from 16 on up for families and individuals with disabilities. We start collecting data, information, and particularly when they reach close to the age of 18, 19, we start planning with the individual themselves and their family members to look at what they truly need. And as Chris says, we identify what we believe the financial and programmatic resources are needed for those individuals. That gets submitted to the legislature, and again, it depends on where New Hampshire is at the time. There's been massive effort for many years to give resources to the waiting list, and occasionally the numbers fall short. It can be because the resources aren't available in the state budget, or in some cases, the numbers that are coming our way are much larger than we had anticipated. We're starting to see large increase of individuals with autism, as an example, and we're starting to track that. So we may plan as a region, and I'll give you an example. Gateways supported over 51 individuals last year, new people coming off the waiting list, and we're anticipating supporting another 39 this coming year. Currently, I have 8 individuals that we have no resources for, and we're looking at that. And then I'm looking towards next year, and there are 40 new individuals who are turning 21 that will need supports by Gateways. So, and I'm one of the larger regions, but that is happening throughout the state of New Hampshire. So we work collectively with the Department of Health and Human Services and with our legislators to define what the needs are, and hopefully through legislative activity, we have wonderful parents. Jennifer is one of them, who are highly involved and really work hard to educate our legislature why this is so important. Today, this is not an entitled program. 21 and older is not entitled. You reference public education. That's an entitled system. At age 21, it is dependent on our state legislature and its appropriations in the budget.
Yeah. Why families, again, often say they feel like they fell off the cliff. I want to invite our listeners to join us and then hear from everybody on this. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Today in the exchange, waiting for services. As Sandy said, for many years, state politicians of both parties have promised to reduce or even eliminate the waiting list of adults with developmental disabilities who are supposed to get state assistance. We're looking at this DD waiting list, as it's sometimes called, and why it persists. Let's hear from you. The exchange number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And Jen, I'd love to hear from you. Chris, you too. Jen, you first, please. Sandy's right. There's been bipartisan effort. I've heard many governors and state house leaders say this is the year where we're going to reduce or even eliminate, some have said, this waiting list, and it never seems to go away. How come?
Well, you know, I think if you look at any social service agencies or system, you know, this has been the case. I think that, you know, with limited resources and, you know, it makes it difficult to meet all the different needs. And I'm glad that Sandy pointed out that from birth to 21, you know, there's that federal entitlement and families, you know, children are entitled to that free and appropriate public education. Our family is a little bit unique in that because of the more profound nature of Chloe's services, we participate on the IHS waiver, the in-home supports waiver. So she does receive a little more support than maybe some other families would. Other reasons for the wait list, again, when that entitlement ends at 21 and it falls back to the state to provide funding for that support, unless your life is touched by the type of situation like we have and you have a child or a family member who experiences a developmental disability, you might not, A, understand exactly what that means, and B, you might think of, you know, and when you look at the budget, it might seem like that portion is so large. Why does it have to be that large? You know, maybe people just need to work harder to be able to support their families. Well, let me tell you, parents have an important partnership with our New Hampshire legislature, the Bureau of Developmental Services, and our area agencies. Parents with children and adult children who have developmental disabilities work around the clock to provide caretaker hours, additional transportation, and things, especially when they become adults, that results in millions and millions of dollars of savings to the state because they're not legally obligated to provide those things, but they continue to do that because they love and care about their family members. So I think it's really important, and the council, you know, we have a mission of helping to educate our policymakers, you know, and empowering families. We advocate. We're appointed by the governor. Every state and territory in New Hampshire, every state and territory in the United States has a DD council that that came out of the DD Act back in 1970, and we're all about advocating and making positive system change so our systems can allow people with developmental disabilities to live as independently as they can and in all aspects of community life, education, recreation, and employment.
Well, and when one shoe drops, sometimes another shoe drops, because as you said earlier, Jen, right now your daughter's getting these services through the school system, allowing you to work and allowing you to support your other three children so that they can go to school and be productive citizens and pay taxes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Right. So it's so important, and I'll continue to work hard to educate other parents to become good advocates, to talk to their local representatives, their New Hampshire state senators. They're so accessible to us in New Hampshire because we have such a large state legislature, to sit down and have coffee with them and learn a little bit about what maybe fueled their passion to serve in the legislature, to learn about them, and then also share what they know. In the small part of humanity, families really are the experts. And our legislators and policymakers, folks at the Bureau who are very dedicated as well, they need to know what we know in order to make responsible policies, policy decisions, so that people with developmental disabilities can live a productive life with dignity and make their contributions.
Do you want to jump in real quick, Chris?
Sure. I really want to kind of build off of what Jen and Sandy were saying about the support to families. You know, about 80% of individuals with disabilities live with families. And I think it's really important that the Bureau and the state of New Hampshire understand and respect the commitment that families are making. And it really helps us in the long run, because when we have our waiting list dollars, we're actually able to stretch them much further, because a family like Jen's, her daughter Chloe will not need 24/7 support, but Jen needs a certain amount of support so that she can continue to work and her family can continue to thrive.
And have some respite time after work.
One of the other pieces I think it's really important is, I think the state of New Hampshire, we do the best we can with the information and the resources we have. Right now we're working on the state budget. But the numbers for the developmental disability waiting list, we had to pull those numbers in August. So for our current biennium that we're in right now, we had to use numbers from August of 2014. A lot can change in a family's life. Jen has a great plan for Chloe, and we can build our supports and the budget around that. But if something changes, either good or bad, we have to adjust. And we don't always have the flexibility to do that. So I think we try to go forward with making the decisions based on the information we have, but we are working and living and with people whose lives change in an instant.
So it's the part of the problem is money. Part of it is just planning. You have to say, this is what I need a year or a year and a half in advance.
Do you know exactly what you need 2 years from now?
No,
you know exactly
I have absolutely no idea what I need next week.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
And I think we have more people coming into the system
absolutely.
Today. And, you know, I asked the intake coordinator over at Community Crossroads, you know, about out of 10 new people that you're doing an intake for, families, how many of those individuals have autism? And she said it's about 7 out of 10. And also, we have more individuals that are coming into the system with more complex needs, which means we're going to need more resources.
Partly due to, I'll ask you this after a break, the closing of Lakeview. That meant more people in the developmental disabilities system. Lots of people want to jump into our conversation, so we'll hear from them in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the Developmental Disability Services wait list, what it is and why it persists despite years of political promises from both sides of the aisle. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Send email to exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Christine Santinello, Sandy Pelletier, Jennifer Bertrand are our guests, and all of you. We're going to go right to our listeners now. And Peter is in Peterborough. Go ahead, Peter. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
How are you today?
Fine. Go ahead, Peter.
My comment is relatively simple. The state has undergone many, many situations throughout the years. I've been here for 14 years, and my view of what's going on is that there is a definite need for an increase in a sales tax. Or some other method to subsidize these issues. Politicians want to keep brushing it off and making excuses why they can't fund these programs, whether it's this particular program or any social program. It's because there's not enough revenue coming in, and they just keep squeezing the same grape over and over again. There's nothing left. You need more cash, more revenue in another way.
Squeezing the same grape over and over again. That's a nice analogy. Thank you for the call, Peter. And I don't think anybody in this panel is up to talking about the benefits of a sales tax. But there is a bill in the legislature being heard later today, Sandy, that would increase funding for up to 2% for this area. What do you think? Would that help?
Absolutely would help. And again, this is an example of bipartisan effort by our legislators, because when I look at the sponsors, it's people from both sides of the aisle. So that's always a very positive thing. This was a major effort to look at where we are. There's been quite a few challenges, particularly right now around finding workforce. I just read a report that says that we have currently 225 individual openings for direct support workforce. And I think Jennifer referred to her Chloe needing individuals that support her daughter one-on-one. These individuals, these staff people, our direct support workforce are really the fabric of the work we do every day. They make a difference in people's lives on a day-to-day basis. And when we have that many open positions, then we're really challenged with our ability to recruit those individuals.
Wait, say that again, Sandy. 225 openings?
Yes, 225 open positions across the state of New Hampshire as of December 2016 for direct support professionals.
Wow, that's a lot. So this is a theme that I hear again and again, Chris, no matter what the field, actually, it seems
right.
Like. There's a huge shortage of skilled workers in various fields. I've talked to people in the mental health field. I've talked to people in the addiction field. No matter what,
and
there's
not
enough.
And it's all intertwined, because you could have a shortage in a home health agency, and then that impacts developmental services because maybe someone needs supports from both organizations. As the department, we support Representative McCann's bill. We did not budget for it. We don't have the resources for it, but it's a hugely important step.
This is the bill to increase funding for your agency by 2%.
The area agencies, absolutely, to have a living wage for their employees. For 10 years, I led an area agency, and it was really difficult to increase wages, health insurance, all of the things that make it a career. And I think as developmental services, we want people to do this as a career so they don't come in and out of families' lives. Families have to tell their stories all the time. And if Chloe makes a huge connection and a relationship with a staff person, it's not just Chloe that has that relationship. Jen and other families are letting other people into their homes, into their lives. And to have that constant turnover is really difficult. We actually started tracking this year with the area agencies how many people are having workforce issues who have waiting list dollars allocated to them, and then they can't find the appropriate workforce. So we have the money, they just can't find the workers. So it is an issue, and it's being addressed in a number of commissions and workforces across the state because it's a state issue.
Go ahead, Jen.
So there was a period of time where it was more than a year that we put out ads in different places and got some potential employees, and then, because of the low employment, there were other more attractive places. We can't offer full-time work and benefits because, Chloe doesn't need 40 hours a week right now because she attends her public school. The New Hampshire Council on Developmental Disabilities, we are supporting HB 387. That's going to be heard this afternoon. I think it's important to note, too, that the area agency system, our developmental services system, hasn't received a rate increase in more than a decade. Think about the cost of living increases. And, you know, I'm excited to learn about, you know, what the area, if this is approved, and I urge our legislators to pass this bill. And I urge parents, if you can't attend today at the hearing at 3:30 at the Legislative Office Building, reach out to our council. We can provide you some information if you want to write a letter of testimony to urge our policymakers to support this. We can help you with that. And you can also participate on our task forces. You don't have to be a council member to work on some key issues that are facing families and individuals in the state. We have to do things that will attract, retain our direct support workforce. They do provide critical services. I could not be able to balance the needs of my family and my daughter's special needs with work and all the other things. And adequate funding is essential. If Chloe couldn't participate on the in-home supports waiver, we wouldn't be able to function. I wouldn't be able to work. My oldest daughter's in college. She's at the University of Vermont. That's really expensive, and I still need to be thinking about the other three and planning for their futures. So thank God we do have, you know, these types of services in New Hampshire, because without it, our family would have been torn apart, and Chloe would not have had the benefit to grow up with her siblings and her family in her community school.
Well, she might have been, in the old days, institutionalized.
Well, so what happens when a family can't manage that? That means that you're looking at maybe a foster care situation or some other type of placement situation.
The exchange number again for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Back to the phones, all of you. And Wayne joins us from Concord. Hi, Wayne. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning, Laura. I think you know me from the voting shows. But what you didn't know is I was president of a community college, the Hidden Assets in Serving Students with Disability. 10 years ago, Senator Kennedy asked me to lead a national effort to build pilot programs at community colleges for autistic students. And we put together, along with Tom Harkin and the Higher Education Act, programs at 28 schools across the country. The placement rate in good jobs was 85% when out of programs, especially at Taft College in California, my sister school in this. I had 500 students with disabilities at North Shore Community College. They had their own honor society, and the results were incredible. And I think, especially in New Hampshire, where I am a state rep, that we need to look at the community colleges that enroll over half of the students with disabilities in the country right now, and they're really set up for it. And I just wanted to make that known as a strategy going forward.
Okay. Wayne, thank you very much for the call. Do you want to jump in, Chris, on that point?
I think, Wayne, thank you very much for bringing that up. I think what Wayne brings as a point is this is not just a developmental disability, Bureau of Developmental Services, area agency issue or concern. I think it's a community concern, and I think if we all come together, all of our lives are enhanced to figure out ways to best support individuals with disabilities in our communities, and there's lots of different strategies.
Wayne, thanks for the call. Here's an email from Shirley in Nashua who says, my daughter fortunately receives services and is not on the wait list at age 23. She has both an intellectual disability and physical disabilities. Besides being the right thing to do, Shirley says, providing services to adults with disabilities through these programs is cheaper than the alternatives. Some alternatives are the parents cannot go to work and pay taxes because they have to stay home and take care of their adult, or their adult must go into a residential facility that is far more expensive. So Shirley says this is good fiscal policy as well as the ethical thing to do. Shirley, thank you for the email. Again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Again, email us, like Shirley did, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Sandy, I want to ask you another question, and this has to do with, again, the budget, competing needs. Everybody's making the case that, you know, funding this program is important. It saves money, as Shirley, our emailer, said. But there are a lot of competing needs this year, Sandy. You know, the opioid crisis. We're under a mental health lawsuit to improve that system. A lot of politicians say DCYF is their priority this year, given that two children who were known to DCYF died. Lots of holes in that system. So I wonder, Sandy, how you make your case in this challenging year.
You bring up a really good point, and obviously all of these needs have to be met in our state, and that's the challenge. I like the analogy, you know, we're squeezing the grape. I think we are, and I think it's really difficult. Obviously, this panel is representing individuals with developmental disabilities and their families, and that's where our passion is, but all those other needs need to be also looked at. There are those crises here in our state, and the legislature needs to take a really good look at what resources are available to meet those needs. But we are a safety net organization. We represent some of the most vulnerable population in the state of New Hampshire, and I think the legislature recognizes that. And as Shirley said, we can do a lot to support an individual so they can lead a very quality, meaningful life. When I started my career, people were still at Laconia State School. Now they're living in the community. They're having job opportunities, maybe at Marshall's. I've witnessed a lot of young students come out of public school, go into some of our programs that help them become employable, and they have part-time jobs. They learn to use the national public transportation, and their level of support is much smaller. They don't need as much service because they've gained so much independence. And I think it's a wise use of our state resources, obviously. And we need to do more of that. I don't want to minimize all the other needs that New Hampshire has because those are real challenges that the state has. And they legislators need to consider it. But obviously, I'm advocating right now for individuals with disabilities and their family, and this waiting list issue is a real one. And if you're a family and your son or daughter are turning 21 in July or June come around, or June 2017, and your son or daughter has no place to go for supports, for residential supports if necessary, or day program supports, families go into crisis, and the individual themselves, who've made a lot of gains to gain resources and gain skills over the past 21 years, it's a real tragedy if we can't support them.
Go ahead, jump in, Chris.
I think one of the things Sandy mentioned is a really good point is, you know, we spend a lot of our resources ensuring that children with disabilities have an appropriate education. And so not funding these young adults as they turn 21 doesn't mean the need's going to go away. It doesn't mean that all of a sudden if you don't give someone funding, they're not going to need it and everything's going to be okay. Lots of times a person has to wait and then they learn some of those really important skills. And I think it was like that Shirley that mentioned it is cost effective. When I was just doing some research, and I don't have it in front of me, but there's about, I want to say there's like 30 to 35 states that still have some form of institution. You know, New Hampshire doesn't have an institution. And so the area agency is our safety net system. But the cost to serve people in the community is so much less expensive. I want to say our average cost across all of our services is maybe $44,000 a year. You compare that to someone who's in an institution, you're talking $300,000 a year in some instances. So it really is a cost-effective model. And like Sandy said, we have lots of needs in this state. But I think right here we're advocating for people with disabilities, but we need to ensure that all families have the abilities.
Go ahead, Jen.
So prior to 1970, before the DD Act was put into place, people with developmental disabilities developmental disabilities did experience a wide range of labels, things like idiot, moron, defective, etc. They also experienced a wide range of reactions, dehumanization, abuse, neglect, injuries. Certainly our service system isn't perfect today. You know, we saw that, you know, with some things that happened at Lakeview. But they also experienced a range of treatments, forced institutionalization, aversive, sterilization, and so many other things. And these attitudes reinforced the segregation, congregation, and dependency on government services and they're being stripped of their civil rights, basically. So, you know, the purpose of the DD Act, which formed our councils, you know, is there so that we can assure individuals with developmental disabilities and their families participate in the design of and have access to needed community services, individualized supports, and other forms of assistance that promote things like self-determination, independence, productivity, integration, inclusion in all facets of community life. And there are consequences for the choices that we make. Yes, all these different social service needs are important, but if we don't fund adequately our developmental service system, families won't be able to shoulder this alone. And then if the state has to take full responsibility for the care of those individuals, it could bankrupt the state. So we have to continue to be good partners and make wise policy decisions.
So if you're saying these services aren't available, families break up, kids may end up in foster care or in institutions. I shouldn't say kids, I should say young adults.
Both.
Where it's way more expensive. Right. And there is that ugly history that we have seen in this state and elsewhere, Jen, of what happens in some of these institutions.
Right. I mean, it makes total financial sense to work together as partners because parents will continue to provide all of those services above and beyond, which translate to millions. And it's a civil rights issue.
Let's take another call. This is Peter in Portsmouth. Hi, Peter. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Yes. Hello, Laura. Hello, guests. This is State Representative Peter Somsich from Portsmouth.
Hi, Peter.
And I want to say I am not on the committee that is handling this bill, but I'm fully supportive of the increases of that bill. And I also want to emphasize that I think what the previous caller back from Peterborough underscored was we just don't have adequate funding for many services in this state because the state is pretty underserved financially, and including kindergarten and other issues. I think it is a problem.
If I could ask you a quick question, because somebody else has made that point as well.
Yeah.
There are a lot of competing needs, as I said, and right now there aren't going to be new taxes. In fact, some taxes will probably be reduced. So in that current context, you know, not what you hope what you wish the state would do, but in the context of understanding what the state will do, which is not increase taxes this year, what do you suggest happens when it comes to sort of parceling out this money for all the other needs we've talked about?
Well, I think there's a lot of wishful thinking going along that money will somehow magically appear. What's most likely, though, is that monies will be shifted around or that there'll be some additional fees or surcharges somewhere showing up that people don't notice that will help fund some of these ideas.
Last year, Democrats said if business taxes were cut, that the budget would explode, there'd be a huge deficit. Instead, the state revenues improved after business taxes were cut. What do you think? I'm guessing you're a Democrat, Peter. If the state cuts business taxes again, might we see more revenue instead of less?
Well, I think the increase in business taxes had more to do with the national economy and not with what we did locally in the state. But what I want to point out as well is that there are many areas of federal funding that we could qualify for if we were able to match some grant money to leverage that money. And we don't do it because we don't have the staffing or the people. And the other thing is, just before we mentioned, we talked about the salaries being paid and people not taking these jobs. That's because we're not adequately compensating these caregivers.
Sure. And that was the focus, I think you said earlier, Chris, of this bill that's going to be heard today. It's for 2% more funding, but specifically for
to assist with compensation of direct support and the workforce in general.
Because you're having such a hard time attracting
people
to this field. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you very much for the call, Peter. We'll take more of your calls in just a moment. Again, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at @NHPRExchange. More on the developmental disabilities wait list in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, waiting for services. We're talking about the developmental disability wait list, what it is, and why it persists despite years of bipartisan political promises. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Send email to exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have three guests with us. Sandy Pelletier joins us from Nashua. She's president and CEO of Gateways Community Services, an agency in Nashua that serves this community. Jennifer Bertrand is with us, co-chair of the Policy Committee for the New Hampshire Council on Developmental Disabilities, and she's been telling us about her daughter, Chloe, who has some challenges. Also with us, Christine Santanello. She's director of the Bureau of Developmental Services at DHHS. That's a relatively new position for Christine. She formerly led Lakes Region Community Services. And all of you, let's go right back to our listeners. And from Peterborough again, Amy joins us. Hi, Amy. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
Thank you. My question would be to Jennifer. I commend you for all your efforts and understand that you were very involved with Chloe's care. My question, or maybe my statement, is I chose to have one child and then found myself in a situation where I am now a single mom, 24/7, 365. I'm responsible for one child. I still have to go to work. I still have to manage all of these situations. And you talk about if something changes in a second. Over the last 2 years, I've battled two different cancers.
Wow.
But
that's
my
tough,
son
Amy.
Does not have developmental disabilities. So where do I find respite, or where does someone in my situation find respite and resources? Because I made the choice to only have one child, because I knew that that is what I was capable of caring for, not having two or three or four children.
Well, Amy, I'm sorry to hear about your struggles. My goodness. And sounds like you got through it. So that's good. Jennifer, you talked earlier. You have Chloe, who has developmental disabilities, and also three other children.
That's correct.
Two boys and a girl. So I just wonder what your thoughts are on that.
Well, thank you for the question. Is it Amy?
Yes.
From Peterborough. Appreciate you asking. Chloe was second born, and there's quite an age difference between Sydney and Chloe, who were the first two, before Avery and Brady came. Once we realized that Chloe had a developmental disability, and she wasn't diagnosed with autism until she was nearly five, by the way, I really wanted to make sure that Sydney had a sibling to be able to have some support in looking out for her sister, because I'm not going to live forever.
So it wasn't all on her.
Right. And I wanted her to have siblings to be able to look out for their sister, because, you know, I'm not going to be around forever. And I would also say, because of the wonderful opportunity that Chloe's siblings have had in knowing her and growing up with her, have given them a deep sense of compassion, understanding. You know, if they have a friend or a family member who has a stroke who communicates differently, they're going to have a lot more knowledge to be able to communicate with them. Also, because they have a sister who experiences a profound developmental disability, they have already advocated for their sister at their local schools. Sydney, my oldest daughter, has gone during the last biennium budget, went and she testified in front of the House Finance Committee. And as a result, I feel like they'll be much more engaged in their democracy and in their civic responsibilities than maybe children or siblings that don't have a sibling without a developmental disability. You know, we work hard, and Chloe has some extensive care needs that are well beyond what a typical child. And I don't think any woman, when she becomes pregnant, thinks that, oh, I'm going to have a child that has a developmental disability. And, you know, granted, we did choose to have the boys after Sydney. And I'm just, you know what, that gives me some hope and comfort that when I'm not here, that they're going to be looking out for her, and they're going to have her back, and they're going to advocate for other individuals as well.
So you're raising three compassionate
hardworking
adult, young adults who will have maybe a little extra piece of heart for people who struggle and who are different, including people who've struggled like Amy with her cancer.
Yeah, and will give to their communities in some very real and profound ways.
Do you want to jump in?
Well, I just was thinking as Jen was so eloquently telling her story, and there's so many families like Jen out there. And what we're seeing is there's a number of adults that have never ever received services at all from the area agency system, and they have aging parents, and all of a sudden something happens to the parents, but yet their siblings are the ones that say to the area agency, I'll take my 40-year-old sister to live with me if you just give us some day supports. I also think demographically we have a workforce shortage. We have the graying of New Hampshire. So, you know, maybe Jen's kids will work somewhere in human services, and if not them, I'm guessing that Jen's children have lots of friends who have now become Chloe's friends and include Chloe in their lives and actually have enhanced their lives as well as Chloe's lives.
Well, Amy, again, sorry to hear about your struggles with cancer, and thank you for calling in. Here's an email. This person did not want to leave a name. I'll throw this to you, Sandy. This person says, with the increase of autism and decrease of services, what happens to clients with severe medical issues other than autism? And thank you for the email. I'd love to hear from you, Sandy, on this, in particular, how the increase in children with autism is now affecting these young adults coming into the developmental disability system.
We are seeing a larger number, obviously, and we're starting to track that information. However, it doesn't preclude us supporting children who have complex medical issues as well. I think if an individual does present with intellectual disabilities and has complex medical issues, and with that chat with as well, we continue to provide supports for those individuals. We're just starting to see a demographic change to some degree. We're trying to get our arms around it. As I stated earlier, we're starting to track the number of individuals with autism as well. We're not sure why all of this is happening. Obviously, there's lots of conversations around why we're starting to see that increase, but no one's really clear. But we really work hard to make sure that all individuals that are eligible for the area agency or the Developmental Disability Service System gets the resources they need to lead a meaningful life.
Did you want to jump in on that too,
well,
Chris?
I was saying we
the
are
rise
working,
in autism and how
we
it's
are
affecting
looking
this.
Closely with the area agencies, because the area agencies are who find individuals with developmental disabilities eligible. And we have seen an increase over, I think, since fiscal year 12. You know, of right now, this past year, we have about 19% of those over the age of 21 have autism. In comparison, in fiscal year 12, only 6%. We're also seeing people that have dual diagnosis, and in our world, that's a mental health disorder as well as a developmental disability. So that is challenges, as well as Sandy said, people that have increased medical needs. Medical technology is wonderful. People are, and also people with disabilities are living longer. I think when our system was first set up back in the late 1980s, when the state school was getting ready to close, the life expectancy for people with disabilities and society in general was much lower. So now we're supporting people to live longer, and hence they're going to need continued services.
Well, I want to thank that person for the email. Again, the email address is exchange@nhpr.org. The phone number is 1-800-892-6477. And let's take Kyle and Hooks at all of you. Hi, Kyle. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead, Kyle.
I'm Kyle, and I'm calling from Maintaining Independence in Hooks It.
Okay.
And I just wanted to throw in the comment that a lot of services do currently exist, and I'm mentioning adult medical daycare. We take lots of developmental disability patients, and for only $49 a day is the reimbursement rate. If new programs are trying to be created or options are made, it's very doubtful that they'll be cheaper than that. So that's my comment, is just if maybe more awareness is brought to the more cost-effective route of providing care, then possibly the general population will be made more aware of that.
Okay, Kyle, thank you for the call. Jen, you look like you want to jump in.
Well, you know, I don't know anything about the program or business that you're referring to, or your funding and the quality of the folks that you employ, and if you take a person-centered directed approach. You know, And I hope that, you know, that's the case.
I think, you know, there's lots of different services out there for the wide range of people in the community. And typical adult daycare is really for families who have elderly people living at home with them. So one of the things that Developmental Services wants to be really careful of is not taking over programs that are really intended for another population, because then that just tips the scale, and then you have families who have aging members at home, and they're having difficulty maintaining
right.
their independence.
And I'd also say, you know, because, you know, we work directly as a family with our area agency to create a vision and a budget. And
relationships.
Right. You know, we're working on making sure that Chloe's being employed in the community so she can earn up to what she can, that she has, civil rights-wise, that she has the same opportunities as anyone so she can participate in recreation and live a good life. And we at the council, we know that people with developmental disabilities have some amazing contributions to make. And people tell me all the time, once they have an opportunity to get to know Chloe, and maybe she's on the high school bowling team, and she did Girls on the Run back in elementary school. They just are so grateful for having the opportunity to get to know Chloe, that, you know, and the things that she can do, and they feel like their life has been enhanced as an opportunity. So any programs that are out there, I would urge parents, you know, to work toward making sure that individuals are out in the community, working, volunteering, and engaging just like anyone else would.
Well, thank you for the call, Kyle. And here's a comment that Edith left on our website. I'll throw this to you, I think, Sandy. She says, please touch on the ramifications of the Ryan/Republican stated intent to turn Medicaid back to the states. Edith asks, specifically, how do you think this will impact the developmentally disabled population? Pros and cons. And Sandy, why don't you take that one?
Laura, there's been lots of conversations in the last few weeks, as you can imagine, around block granting Medicaid to the states. And the developmental disability system is really run on waivers, which are Medicaid, federal Medicaid dollars, which are matched by the state legislature, by the states. And we're not sure. I mean, obviously, we're concerned because there's limited resources that are assigned to the developmental disability system, and we want to make sure that those resources stay aligned for this population that we have responsibility for. So there's been a lot of dialogue. We're not sure yet. This is new information that's coming out of Washington with some considerations to give the states more flexibility, giving them block grant money through Medicaid and allowing the states more flexibility and latitude. I think as advocates and policymakers in the developmental disability field, we just want to have assurances that the resources that are intended for the individuals that we support daily are there for them. So we'll see. It's interesting times, and we're anxious to see how the debate proceeds.
Lots of uncertainty. Go ahead, Jen.
So block granting Medicaid would mean that you cap it, regardless of the number of individuals and what the needs are. Period. The National Council on Disability, if you Google them online, they have they commissioned a report about the potential impacts of block granting specifically to Medicaid and individuals with developmental and intellectual disabilities. I urge parents, lawmakers, go take a look at that report and take a look at the negative outcomes and how this would negatively impact our family members, our fellow citizens, our neighbors who experience developmental disabilities. The first entitlement to be made into a block grant was TANF. I was just reading about this last weekend.
So we used to call welfare, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Temporary aid to needy families.
Yeah, so no, it's no longer an entitlement. And they also analyzed that and the outcomes. So I would urge people, I do not support, as a family member, and I haven't discussed this on my policy committee yet for the council, so I'm speaking as Jennifer, the parent. but I do not support block granting. I think that there would be detrimental impacts to individuals with developmental disabilities.
Well, Edith, thank you for the question. And, you know, another question that comes up when you look at this, especially recently, in addition to money, management of the program has occasionally been a problem in the past. Now, Christine, recognizing that you were not the head of the Bureau at this point in time, but about a year ago, lawmakers and families were furious when an audit was released showing that the Department of Health and Human Services didn't spend $40 million earmarked for people with developmental disabilities, even though there was a waiting list of about 100 people. Everybody was asking. You were at an area agency at the time. You were probably asking.
I was probably asking, too.
The same thing. I think people were going crazy over this.
You know, and I want to say I really believe it was an anomaly. That is not an issue right now. I'm actually watching all of our resources to ensure we don't overspend because we are trying to meet the needs. I think the audit brought out some really good things for us to work on and that we are working on. I think our developmental services system is a very mature system. And so as our population change, as the needs change, we sometimes have to look at how do we operate, how do we communicate. So there were a couple of really good recommendations. There was lots of recommendations, and we are tackling all of those away. One of them was to write in the currently or historically, our dollars have, they lapse. They don't carry over from one year to the other in the biennium at all state agencies.
Yeah, if you don't spend it, that's it.
It's gone. So as a result of the audit, there was actually, I think it was House Bill 1394 was passed that allowed us to carry forward our dollars, which was really helpful. We've also, because of the audit, had to track all of our expenditures, and it's complicated because we have two different lines, developmental services maintenance, developmental services waiting list, but our MMIS system brings it all in as one. So we're manually tracking because we don't have IT systems to help us track how we're spending our dollars.
You're manually tracking
that. We have
that.
Spreadsheets all over my office. So one of the great things out of the LBA audit is the department put forward in the prioritized needs budget an IT system for the area agencies. And it would be wonderful because it would be area agencies and the Bureau of Developmental Services that would both have access.
Well, we've barely scratched the surface. Jen, did you have one last quickie comment?
Yeah.
First, I want to just thank you, Laura, for bringing this issue forward. Hopefully, more New Hampshire citizens understand what individuals with developmental disabilities and their families need, and it's been a great partnership with our legislature and our department and our families. Our families are great advocates, and they need to continue to advocate for their sons and daughters, and I want to just thank you for bringing this issue forward. It's an important one, and we don't want any of our individuals that we support to fall off the cliff. So.
Well, Sandy, thank you. And by the way, the conversation always continues online on Facebook. So people whose emails I didn't get a chance to read, or if you still want to comment, go to our Facebook page. Jen, real quick.
Yes, thank you, Laura, too, for having me as a representative of the New Hampshire Council on Developmental Disabilities. And our council will continue to work hard to partner and collaborate with the Bureau, with the area agency system, with our elected officials, our legislators, because it's only together, families, stakeholders, that we can improve and make systematic changes to better serve people with developmental disabilities.
Jen, thank you so much. And Chris, thank you
thank
as
you.
Well. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.